Hello, everyone, and welcome. Welcome to the Power of Privilege and Allyship podcast. My name is Funke Avinbola, and I'm the CEO and founder of the Austin Bronte Consultancy. The consultancy's main goal is to improve leadership by leveraging the impact of diversity, inclusion, belonging, and equity across the business world. Now, today, I am honestly beyond excited to be speaking to Harriet Johnson. Harriet, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me.
I'd love, Harriet, if you could introduce yourself to our audience in your own words. You've done some incredible things, but how would you like to introduce yourself?
I'm a barrister. I practice at Doughty Street Chambers. I've been there for, well, I've been in practice for about 10 years. Most of that has been at Doughty Street. My professional work is quite broad and quite varied, actually. I do criminal defence work. I do civil liberties and human rights work. I'm currently working on the inquiry into the bomb at the Manchester Arena in 2017. I do a lot of women's rights work. So I've spent a lot of time defending women charged with serious crimes when those crimes have arisen out of coercive control or other abuse. I bring civil actions against the police on behalf of women who have reported serious incidents to the police and not been taken seriously. So I do quite a lot of women's rights work within my practice. Since being at Doughty Street, a few years ago now, it was 2016, I did a stupid thing where I rang our senior clerk and said, hey, we should do something for International Women's Day about, you know, what more the law can do to help women or something like that. And he said, that's a great idea, you do it. And from then on, it spiraled and become this enormous event that we run every year. Last year was remote, obviously. The year before that, we just managed to miss the pandemic because it was the 8th of March. So just before everything locked down, but we still had a lot of stuff online. And there's an enormous team of women at Doughty Street running it now who are doing an incredible job. And every year it's the same question. It's what more can the law do for women? And sometimes that's for the women that we represent. Sometimes it's what more can we do for women in law? Usually it's a combination of both of those things, because as you know probably better than anybody, when you're talking about diversity inclusion, there's no bad outcome. There's no negative result to involving, in this case, more women in things. So that's it. I also do some consultancy with a company called the Open Side Group, where I talk about, well, I mainly talk about storytelling, but it's a consultancy that also draws on some of the experiences I've had in law and that other consultants have had within their slightly more corporate environments than the lefty pinko human rights set that I'm at now. So that's it. That's way more than a few sentences, I'm afraid. Sorry.
No need to apologise at all, Harriet. You know, I'm just so keen for our audience to get a true sense of who you are. And I think that really came across. It's very hard to define what you do, Harriet, isn't it? Because, you know, you can't just say, I'm a barrister. I mean, Doughty Street Women is a massive, massive part of what you do. And certainly what absolutely convinced me that I'd love to have you as a guest on this show.
That's really kind of you. I have to say, In fact, I make the same joke every year that I get to experience what it's like being a man, because I have the idea and did almost nothing since then. But I get all of the credit every year, which is lovely. So yeah.
That's absolutely wonderful. So I'd be so intrigued, Harriet, to know a bit more about your actual career as a barrister. You know, how has that panned out? What made you decide to become a barrister? And what were the steps you had to take to get to where you are now?
I fell into it by accident, really. I often tell people that I became a barrister because I met a man in a pub. And that is sort of the short answer. I was working in a pub in the summer of my second year at university. And it was a beautiful country pub, gastro pub. And it was in a very sort of beautiful countryside area with lots of Tories. And I was 20 and doing a degree in philosophy and politics. So of course was at my most left wing at that point. And there was one local that I would always have big discussions about politics with. And they were always very friendly and very lovely and well-intentioned and well-meaning. And I got a lot from them. And one day I said to him, what's it like to be a barrister? And he said, well, why don't you come and shadow me for a week and find out? And I spent a week shadowing his colleague in the end at the Crown Court in Salisbury, defending a classic Section 18 case where our client had been attacked and his friend had been attacked, and then our client arguably went a bit over the top in his response. He worked for a company that was contracted to the RAF, so if he got convicted, it wasn't just a risk of prison, but he'd lose his entire career. His wife was sitting in the public gallery about 9.5 months pregnant, and he was the nicest man I'd ever met. And it was one of those instances where he'd just, you know, been in an awful situation and done what I think most of us would do to protect ourselves, but ended up being prosecuted for it. And the day he was acquitted at the end of the week was such a brilliant day. I found myself more and more often thinking, not just this is really interesting, this would be a really interesting career, but sitting in court and thinking, I want to have a go. I want to have a go right now because this looks really fun. And it sort of fell under the umbrella that I had. I, as I said, I did a degree in philosophy and politics. So that's a fair sign that you've got no intention of having a real job when you grow up. So when I was 16, my older brother was killed in a car crash. He was 18 at the time. My little sister was 10. And it was just about, as you can imagine, the most horrific thing that could possibly happen. He was the loveliest man. And we were just getting to that point in our relationship where we were starting to become best friends instead of fighting like cat and dog all the time. And it hit me really hard. And it hit me really hard, even though I had and still have the most wonderful group of friends from school. I had incredible teachers. I had a headmistress who took me aside and gave me permission to kick her out of her own office whenever I wanted to. There was a counsellor at school. I could not have had more support. And yet it completely toppled me. And then shortly afterwards, I started my politics A-level. And I was reading the papers every day as part of that and seeing people who'd not just lost one loved one, but had lost all of their families and all of their possessions and had nothing, and there was nobody helping them. And it sounds very grandiose, but you know, I was 16. It made me think, I don't ever want anybody to have to feel the way that I feel ever again. And of course, there's no way achieving that. But it did make me think that I wanted a career where perhaps when people were having a difficult time, I could hold their hand a little bit. And that's, you know, I'm not smart enough to be a doctor. So there was this umbrella criterion first of, I want a career where I can help people somehow. And then sitting in that pub on a warm Friday afternoon one summer, it clicked into place for me, because this is a man going through the most difficult time of his life. And the barrister who was representing him didn't just do a brilliant job in court. He also did a brilliant job outside of court. He reassured him, he walked him through this complex and I think often alienating process, and it all added up to me. So that was how I ended up being a barrister.
I'm so sorry to hear about your brother. You know, it's just one of these things where we experience these, you know, tragic events, and we have a choice, don't we then, Harriet? What do we do with that? You know, and we really do have that choice. And it's just remarkable listening to how you channeled your grief into some purpose. And the empathy that comes through in your voice is so evident as I'm interviewing you, Harriet. You know, it's so sorry. I just wanted to give you my sincere condolences again.
That's really kind. Thank you. It's a strange thing because, especially with the inquest work and the inquiry that I'm doing at the moment, I deal with families who have lost loved ones. And I think the one thing that maybe we learn from grief is that there's no one experience of it. It hits everybody in such different ways. And for some people, it can be this enormous driver. For other people, it can be the thing that makes them shut down entirely. And there's a whole range of emotions and responses in between, from anger to joy to passion to complete withdrawal. So in some ways, I feel frustrated that having my own experience of grief doesn't give me the magic word to say to people going through their own. You sort of feel like you should at least get that out of it. But I do feel like knowing that I will never know that person's unique experience of grief, knowing that there's no good thing I can say that'll make it better for them, I do feel like that's a personal experience that definitely helps me professionally.
No, I can definitely see that, Harriet, definitely. And I suppose, you know, being a corporate lawyer, we're on very, very different, you know, and I'm also a solicitor and you're a barrister. I'm intrigued. What is Section 18? Am I being completely ignorant?
I'm so sorry. I was talking about how the man made law accessible and I used terrible legal terminology in doing it. What a disaster. So Section 18 is Section 18 of the Offences Against a Person Act, and it's causing grievous bodily harm with intent. And in extreme cases, you can go to prison for the rest of your life for it. So it's a very serious thing. But it's also probably the thing that scares the life out of me most, because I've had so many clients over the years, especially when I was a bit more junior, who threw a punch in the split second, you know, in a split second of anger. And then that resulted in a person hitting their head or serious injuries, and suddenly their whole life is in the balance. And it's always terrified me how quickly those things can spiral out of control. So my friends will tell you, I'm always the one in the pub that wants us to leave. Just whenever anybody says anything, I just, right, let's go right now.
It's so important to be aware of that, Harriet. And I'm really glad I asked that question, because we have some relatively young listeners. You know, we've got school-aged children. There are real consequences, right, to these behaviours. And it can, you know, can only help really for us to sort of highlight that something like a pub brawl could have serious consequences for you later on.
It is absolutely terrifying. And I've had quite a lot of very young clients, but also clients who, you know, you watch an episode of EastEnders and somebody throws a punch and literally nothing happens. There are no consequences. Whereas in real life, if you throw a punch, then potentially you get charged, you get a criminal record, you are limited in your options in terms of travel. You might not be able to travel to America. There are certain jobs that you might not be able to get, anything involving caring or teaching or where you might be with vulnerable people. Suddenly, even if you don't go to prison, which is the immediate consequence that people always think of accidentally or impulsively committing crimes, even if you don't go to prison, it has a huge impact on the rest of your life. So there's my nagging bit done for the younger listeners.
That's very, very helpful to you. And for me also. I mean, not that I'm prone to fighting in pubs.
I know what you're like, Funky. I just...
It's a very, very timely reminder, I think, of what could happen in the pub brawl. But no, thank you for explaining that. And it always sounds so seamless, doesn't it, when we talk about our careers, Harriet? I'm doing this now, and it's very factual. We you know, spew out these facts, but of course we've all faced challenges, right? You know, it's not a linear process. So I'd be really intrigued if you could share some of the challenges that you faced with us, and importantly, Harriet, how you managed to overcome those challenges.
So I was thinking about this, and I think actually I've been incredibly lucky in my career, which is a weird thing to say because I am about to talk to you about instances of discrimination that I've suffered. But in the context of those instances, and especially relevant to this podcast and the things that you talk about on it, it's important at the outset to recognize that although I've suffered sexism and misogyny in my career, I'm able-bodied, I'm white, I'm middle class. I didn't grow up with a lot of money around me, but I have parents who, if it all fell apart, would welcome me home. All of those things are privileges that have meant that I've had to overcome far fewer challenges than other people might have done. But there have definitely been times when it's that little prickly feeling when you realise that something's not quite right. I think I experienced it most in the set where I did Pupillage, which doesn't exist anymore. It's sort of broken up and become various other sets. But I did Pupillage for a year. There was me and another woman who I won't name because I haven't asked her permission. But we became very, very close right at the beginning. In fact, before we started Pupillage, we went for a pint together and made a firm agreement that we were going to be a two-person support group to get us through this year. For your listeners who might not know what Pupillage is the professional qualifying part of becoming a barrister. So once you've done your law degree or equivalent, then you do a year of professional training, which is academic. And then once you finish that, you have to get something called Pupillage, which is where you spend a year with the first 6 months shadowing barristers and the second 6 months typically actually in practice on your feet conducting your own cases. Pupillage is they always talk about it being very hard to get. And I know that for the pupillage that myself and my friend did, there were 400 applicants for those two places. So I had to kill a lot of people to get to the top of that list, but I managed it, which was good. But we both struggled in that environment. Culturally, it was very backwards, very traditional, which I think is true of a lot of barrister sets, and I think might be true of the law in general. You, I know, have had similar experiences where you think you're in the 21st century, and then you walk into a room and suddenly realise that you're in 1940 somewhere. It's tough. You know, there were remarks made about my appearance. There were remarks made about my friend's appearance. There were inappropriate remarks made about the two of us and how close we were. All of these things that at the time I said nothing about, because we were constantly being told how lucky we were to be there, what a privilege it was to be there, how many other people would kill for our job. And crucially, that at the end of that year, there would be a decision as to which of us, potentially both of us, but also which of us might be taken on full time for a permanent position. So they tried very hard to introduce that degree of competitiveness between us, but we remained very supportive and we're still very, very close now. At the end of that year, I found the culture so difficult that even though I was, in fact, we were both offered tenancy at the end, I chose to go and do another pupillage somewhere else because it wasn't a set that I wanted to be at. The culture felt toxic in a number of ways, not just sexist, but also at times openly racist, at times passively racist, if I can put it like that. So the woman I did pupillage with is black, and there was one particular member of chambers who, whenever he had client conferences, would ask me to sit in and do the work and take notes and contribute, and would ask her to make the tea. And the first time that happened, I thought maybe he's alternating, but when it happened the second time and the third time, it was a horrific and painful realization that it wasn't anything to do with my merit that meant I was getting to take those notes. And I imagine it was considerably worse for my friend. But it was a thing that we talked about quite openly. And I think we learned a lot from each other through that process. I certainly learned a lot from her and continue to learn a lot from her about everything, to be honest, because she's a very, very good friend. But that's, you asked about how to overcome those challenges. For me, having an intelligent, kind, sensitive, thoughtful sounding board in the form of that woman, my very good friend, made everything easier, because it meant when I got a call from my supervisor at 11 o'clock at night saying, I need you to draft these submissions for me, can you have them by 7 tomorrow? I could ring my friend and express my my outrage and wonder whether this was normal, and just to have that reflected back that no, this is not normal, this is as stressful as you think it is. It's like the opposite of gaslighting. It was reassurance that how I was feeling was normal, that my feelings were valid. And I did the same for her over the year. And that's how we got it, you know, got through it together. The bar is not traditionally what you might think of as a caring profession. It's certainly caring in terms of clients. And I've seen barristers go to extraordinary lengths for their clients. And again, I ought to be clear, I'm talking about in general, and there are certainly really important exceptions. But I think traditionally it hasn't been a profession that's cared a lot for its members. There has always, or at least as long as I've been at the bar, been a culture of working until you drop. There's been a sort of certain pride in missing family holidays because you're working too hard. That badge of honour about how seriously you must be taking it. I'm sure you must have experienced something similar when you were in corporate law, probably even worse.
It's very, very similar. Very, very similar longhouse culture. I remember being sort of not so much missing out on family holidays or that sort of thing, but it was a badge of honour. You know, I think, you know, frankly, the corporate lawyers, myself included, were probably a bit arrogant about the fact that we were bringing in a lot of the fees and all this kind of stuff. So, yes, it's a double-edged sword, though, isn't it, Harriet, really?
It really is. It takes an enormous toll. And not only is it completely the wrong way morally to conduct a business or to run a company, it's also completely backwards in terms of profitability and output. Because if you've got 100 people starting at the same time, and by the time they've been doing it for 10 years, 50% of them are burnt out, then you're losing a tremendous input from your workforce. losing a tremendous investment that you've put into those people for all that time. You're losing their experience, the benefit of their insight, and to nothing, for no reason, for an entirely avoidable reason. And it's an issue that comes up more and more when we talk about what we call the drop-off of women at the bar in particular. And for a long time, it's been thought that, or I've heard it said, that women get to about 10 years call, which is, well, I'm 11 years now, so we get to about my stage, and then they leave because they want to have children. And I'm sure that's true for a lot of women, because most barristers are self-employed and it's very difficult to manage being self-employed. And there's very little predictability in a lot of cases for most barristers. So that doesn't necessarily go hand in hand with having children when you don't get things like sick pay or maternity pay or holiday pay. And I can well see why a lot of parents, not just women, choose to leave the profession. But I think it's also, you know, a pattern that I've seen from a lot of women I know is you get to 10 or 11 or 12 or 15 years in and you start thinking, I don't want this to be my professional life. And I think it's easy to write it off as women wanting to have babies, but it's not that simple. I think the profession definitely needs to be more supportive of parents who want to have children, because male colleagues of mine have really struggled since they've become fathers. And that's just as unfair as it is for women who struggle since becoming mothers. But I think also just for our own sanity and our own well-being.
That is so true. And the thing is, you know, I think when you look at the typical day for the professions generally, you know, law, medicine, accountancy, you know, these sort of bastions of old professions, if you like, the long hours culture, the brutality quite often of the typical day seems so deeply entrenched that, you know, how do we start to break down some of those systems? It's a very challenging issue, isn't it?
It really is. And I think a huge part of it is actually just conversation. And this is certainly something that I've been guilty of, with this old saying that comparison is the thief of joy. I think it's very easy, especially when you're at a set like Doughty Street and you look around, and it's very easy to think, I've failed because I'm 36 and I haven't got an OBE yet. But that's not a normal standard for achievement. It's just that, unfortunately or fortunately, depending on which way you look at it, I'm in a set surrounded by some incredibly talented people. It's very, very easy to hear about what your colleagues are doing and to think, well, I must be doing terribly. I'd better work harder. Whereas actually the most incredible advice I've had at the bar has been, well, in fact, first of all, on the first day of pupillage from the man who then became head of chambers, who is a brilliant man, a highly respected QC. And he said to me and my friend on our first day of pupillage, he said, there will be times when you feel like you've got no idea what you're doing and you're about to get found out at any moment. And I thought, oh no, this man can see inside my head. But he said, I still feel like that about 20-30% of the time. And just that acknowledgement from a man who I thought knew everything and had everything together made me feel so much better, because he'd openly admitted it. He hadn't said, I always know what I'm doing, hadn't even implied that. But I think we're so encouraged, especially within law, to give that impression of perfect competence at all times, perfect preparedness at all times, and being willing to give everything up at all times for this job, that for somebody to say, I've just had to return this case because I'm not missing my family holiday, or for somebody to say, I'm going to take this month off because I feel like my well-being is suffering, is such a powerful thing to say. And in terms of role models and mentorship, I think that's one of the most powerful examples that people can give.
It really is. And really, you know, that's what authentic leadership is about, Harriet, isn't it? In the true sense of the word, you know, we shouldn't be afraid to show vulnerability. It's not the sign of weakness. It's actually a sign of remarkable strength, in my view.
Absolutely. Nobody is completely strong all the time. The worst thing you can do is pretend that you are. Worse for you and worse for everybody else. In fact, it's a conversation that comes up a lot around issues of diversity and inclusivity as well. The most damaging thing an organisation can do is pretend that there isn't a problem. If you're involved in an organisation and you don't think that organisation has a problem with racism or with sexism or with ableism, then all that that tells me is that you don't know what's going on in your organization, because organizations draw, you know, they're made up of people that come from a society that unfortunately has structural problems with racism and with sexism and with ableism and with all sorts of other bigotries. That's not to say that any of those bigotries will be being deliberately enforced, but I think the worst thing you can do is pretend that there's no problem because you can't see it. And it's the same with well-being. Pretending there's no problem is just a sign that you haven't really allowed yourself to think that there might be a problem, because anybody who gives you an honest answer about their well-being after the last 18 months would, I think, unless they're incredibly lucky, would be inclined to tell you that there have been times that have been really, really tough.
Absolutely. Gosh, I mean, just before starting recording, we were talking about that, weren't we? You know, it's been challenging. I actually don't know anybody who hasn't had well-being being compromised by all of this. And I think let's hope that we all hold on to that transparency around that now, Harriet, really going forward. But we keep talking about, you know, bits and pieces of what would be your typical day. But I'd love to get a sense, Harriet, of what a typical day is like in the life of a high-flying barrister such as yourself.
Well, that's me. You know, it's all Armani suits and cocktails, and no, it's sadly not. It's, I think the one thing to say about being a barrister is that there isn't really a typical day, which isn't a helpful answer. But at the moment, because I'm currently working on a large public inquiry, my typical day is quite boring. I get up when I'm not in self-isolation, which I am at the moment, which is frustrating, but there we go. When I'm not in self-isolation, I go for a run or take the dog for a walk, and then start work at my desk, because the inquiry I'm working on is still sitting largely remotely, which I have to say has been quite nice for me at times, because it means less commuting, which is always lovely. But I do miss seeing my clients face to face, and I miss physically being in court. There's still that bit of me that feels like I'm sitting in the public gallery at Salisbury Crown Court wanting to have a go. It's been a little while since I've been physically in court, and I miss it. And that's, you know, that's my working day. I'm watching hearings, taking notes, doing paperwork, planning cross-examinations for future witnesses. So in a couple of weeks, I'm going to be in court for the first time physically for another case of mine. I'm desperately excited about it, even though it means a 6 a.m. start to drive to Newcastle for a very short court hearing in which I will probably say yes, no, no, yes, thank you, and then leave. But I'm very excited about that because it means a chance to be on my feet again. And I think for most barristers, the thrill of being on your feet is the reason you do it. There is no joy in the world like giving what you know is a good jury speech. It's the loveliest feeling in the world. My days at the moment tend not to be that long, which is lovely. And I feel enormously lucky to be in that situation because I'm mainly working on this one big case with a few others as well. I'm usually able to stay on top of my work during the working week. That certainly hasn't always been the case, and I suspect might not be the case once this inquiry is over and I'm working on more cases rather than this one big one. But the nice thing about being a barrister is, well, being a self-employed barrister, is that I do get to decide when I do the work. I have deadlines like anybody else has, but if it's Friday afternoon and I just can't be bothered and I think I'd rather do this on Monday morning, then I can leave and that's it and I'm done. Likewise, you know, from time to time, if court finishes at 10:30, then I can go and get my hair cut or have a coffee or see a friend, obviously, when all of those things were allowed. So it's flexible, which is one of the things that I like about it.
No, it just sounds so empowering to have that autonomy, which I'm hearing very clearly in your voice. And the flexibility is important. It really is.
I mean, I've had times when I've been on secondment, and obviously before I came to the bar, lots and lots of temp jobs doing different things. And that was the thing I always struggled with, was having to ask when I was allowed to go and have lunch, whereas normally I like to eat at least 8 or 9 meals a day.
Oh, I love that. Absolutely love it. And Harriet, we've already started talking, haven't we, about some of these themes like privilege, you know, why diversity and inclusion is so important, allyship and so on. But I'd love to hear from you, Harriet. What does privilege mean to you? What's your definition of privilege?
I've been thinking about this, and I think it's a difficult word isn't it? I think it's a word that can instinctively invite defensiveness in people. I think if you tell any person that they have benefited from privilege, it's likely that their mind will flick immediately to a time when they've experienced struggle. And there is very often this knee-jerk response to say, well, yes, but I've also had this and I haven't had this. So I think the best way I can describe my understanding of what privilege is as an absence of one particular type of struggle. So that's not to say that you won't have had any struggle in your life, but you might not have had struggle because of X, Y, and Z. So you can have, let's take a single white male walking down the street. He might be the beneficiary of white privilege, male privilege, cis het privilege, the privilege of being able-bodied. But for example, if he grew up in extreme poverty, or if his parents were physically and emotionally abusive, then he's still likely to have faced an enormous number of challenges that other groups might not have done. So it's not as simple as saying, you're a straight white man, you've had an easy life. It's a question of recognizing that the struggles that he has had are unlikely to be because of his race or his sexuality or his gender. So I think we have to be clear what we mean about privilege. I think it's often used reductively. And I think the conversation around privilege, and one of the reasons why I really like your podcast, is because there is a great deal of nuance to it. There are all of these different parts of it, and we have the ability to talk about all of them rather than using privilege as a one word substitute for something else that very often gets misinterpreted.
Yes, I love that, the absence of, you know, the way you've used that in your definition is really, really, it's an eye-opener. And I really love asking my guests that question, because I learn so much from you, you know, how you're seeing privilege. And just leading on from that, Harriet, allyship, that's yet another buzzword, isn't it, that we're hearing a lot of these days. What does allyship mean to you?
Well, again, I think it's a word that I, in a dream world, I would hear less of, because it would be the default. It would be the norm. To me, allyship is being a good person. That's what it means. It's what we would expect any good person to do. So it's understanding that other people will have different experiences to you, that while that doesn't invalidate your own personal struggles, it's really important to understand the struggles that other people have had. It's not performative. It's not, you know, hashtag ally. It's listening and it's learning and understanding and trying to empathize with the different struggles that other people have had and the unfairness that other people have suffered, and understanding that the one takeaway from allyship is that it's not about you. It's about other people. But it is equally about speaking up when nobody else does, or when nobody else will, and acknowledging that if, for example, my friend in pupillage were to accuse somebody in chambers of being racist, there would be certainly people who would accuse her of quote unquote playing the race card. Whereas if I accused somebody of using racist language, or even just said, I think that that's quite racially insensitive, I'd be much less likely to get the sort of pushback that she would. So it's about using your voice to amplify rather than to speak for, I think, really importantly. But I think it's also about recognizing the fact that if a person is suffering from prejudice or disadvantage in one particular way, it can't always be their job to call it out or to talk about it, because that's one of the burdens of it. And one of the privileges I have is that I'm not constantly being asked about racism, and I'm not constantly being asked, for example, to talk about my own experiences of racism in my life, and I don't constantly have to suffer them. And that, in fact, makes it much less emotionally draining for me to call out racist behaviour than perhaps for somebody who has had those experiences.
Yes, that's a really, really clear way of putting it. And I love what you say about effectively decentering yourself from that whole conversation. It is so key, isn't it, that it's not about you, it's about those that you're being an ally to. You know, that's a very important message. And certainly, you know, having founded Doughty Street Women, you will know why diversity and inclusion is so important. Harriet, but I'd love to get a sense from you of why it matters so much to you that we get this right.
I think there's two parts to it. And I think the thing that baffles me about reluctance to embrace and engage with diversity and inclusion is that if you took a board of any company and said, I can guarantee that if you follow these steps that I'm talking about, you will become more productive and more profitable than your competitors who aren't doing it, they would jump at the chance. They would bite your hand off. Studies have repeatedly and consistently shown that companies with diverse and inclusive, so I was listening to something recently that said diversity is being invited to the party, inclusion is being asked to dance. If you have a diverse and inclusive board, the data shows us time and time again that you're going to be more productive and more profitable. So it's not even a question of doing the right thing at great personal sacrifice or at great sacrifice to your company. It baffles me that even knowing that, even if we put the humanity and the morality to one side, that it's still a conversation we have to have with companies about improving diversity and inclusion in their boards and, you know, from top to bottom. But I think far, far more important than that, far, far more important than what we can get from it is just basic humanity. Just nobody would like to imagine that they might be bored into a world that wasn't going to listen to them. And I think if you were asked before you were born to design the world into which you'd be born, not knowing what member of society you might be, not knowing what your ethnicity might be, not knowing whether you'd be wealthy or not, not knowing whether you'd have a disability or not, you would design a much, much fairer world than the one we have now. And I think it's basic humanity to acknowledge the struggles that people have that are not fair. There are things that we can't do anything about, you know, accidents and natural disasters and things that we can't possibly prevent. But where there are tragedies and struggles that are inherently avoidable and do so much damage, it must be our basic responsibility as human beings to try to mitigate that or try to limit that in some way. So it's the right thing to do is the other answer. And also it just makes everything in life better to not just hear one opinion, to not just hear one voice, to not just have people who agree with you all the time, and to not just be talking to people who've had the same life experience as you. Imagine the dullness. I cannot picture how boring life would be if nobody ever told you that you were wrong or disagreed with you or even just had a different experience to you. If the only people you ever met had identical lives to you, life would be intolerable. It's a much, much better life, and I think it's eminently achievable.
I do too. And I'm smiling as you say that last bit about being challenged and so on, because I had a conversation with a friend of mine, a really good friend, last week, who I rely on very heavily for tough criticism. You know, you have friends who you know are coming from a good place, but are the sort of very strong, rational thinkers. And I'm smiling because I almost said that to this individual, that I really need you to, you know, to not agree with me. You know, don't feel you have to. Yes. So it
the is, critical friend. We all need a critical friend. I mean, we need critical people who aren't our friends too. And we need to be able to, I mean, that's the dream life skill, and one that I wish I had, is the ability to listen to criticism without getting hurt or defensive. I'm not saying for a moment that it's easy, but it's absolutely invaluable to be able to listen to criticism and improve. I mean, anybody who has written anything, you must have had this time and again when you were studying for your doctorate, you know, I, as brilliant as you are, I cannot imagine that you had a piece of work that came back with no red pen on it, or whatever the contemporary equivalent of red pen is. I can't imagine that. And I imagine that any changes that you were advised to make made the piece of work better, and that, you know, input from others is absolutely vital.
It really is. Although in the spirit of full transparency, it was an honorary doctorate. So I know there's so many people from the University of Hertfordshire who subscribe to this podcast, so I couldn't possibly pretend that I actually did a full-blown PhD. But
I've dropped you in it. I'm sorry.
Oh, no, not at all. I'm very open about it. I'm very, very honest about the fact that it was an honorary doctorate. But
well, it's not like, you know, it's not like there's not been any work that you've done in your life, you know. as far as I can
exactly
tell.
I'd like to extend that principle to some of my earlier academic aspects of my training, but yeah. It's a really important point that you're raising, you know, joking aside, Harriet, and I just love, you know, your turn of phrase, but of course you are a barrister, you've got a way with words, and it's been wonderful talking to you, Harriet. The time has absolutely flown by, and I suppose, you know, I always like to give our guests a final chance to say anything that they may not have had the chance to say. So is there anything that you'd like to say before we close our conversation?
And it does very much follow on from what we were just talking about diversity, not just of human beings, but diversity of ideas and diversity of thought. So I mentor 4 young people, all of whom are women. And the question that keeps getting asked, or the comment that keeps getting made, is, but I don't know if I'm necessarily a good fit for the law. I don't know if I look like a lawyer. I don't know if I sound like a lawyer. I don't know if I dress like a lawyer. I mean, you can see me now very much dressed not like a lawyer, because I think it's really important for us to not dress like lawyers sometimes. But the best lawyers don't think like lawyers. And I'm sure that is an experience that you've had in your life as well. The best doctors don't necessarily think like doctors. The best of anything doesn't necessarily come through the same route that you'd expect it to. Some of the most brilliant barristers in my chambers came from backgrounds where statistically they were far more likely to be convicted of a crime than to be in court for any other reason. And they are the best barristers because, well, for a whole host of reasons, but I imagine one of them is that they don't meet their clients and feel like they're in an entirely different world. There's no ivory tower problem. There's no problem of having been indoctrinated into what the law tells us it should be. The best lawyers think creatively about how to use the law to achieve the ends that they want. So if there are any of your younger listeners thinking that they would like to be a lawyer, but they don't know if they want to do a law degree, or they don't know if they sound like you or I, or if they look like you or I, or any of those stereotypes that we have about what lawyers ought to be. You know, when we picture a lawyer, most people picture an old white man. The law is no longer like that. But also, if people who weren't old white men kept deciding the law wasn't for them, then the law would never change. And we need people who don't think like lawyers to actually change the law.
Yeah. And what a powerful way for us to be ending our conversation. Honestly, I'm sure that our year 13 listeners, year 12s, year 11, will be writing down notes and actually quoting you in their applications for law degrees at various universities all across the world, Harriet.
Well, then I'm extra proud that I managed not to swear.
Harriet, it's been an absolute delight talking to you. Thank you so much for your time.
It's been wonderful. Thank you so much.
And thank you, our lovely listeners, for helping us to grow this community around privilege, allyship, and what it might mean. You know, please do keep sharing and subscribing, and please do leave a rating for us on Apple Podcasts. We really appreciate your support. And I look forward very much to my next conversation with yet another truly inspiring leader, just like Harriet Johnson. Thank you very much, everyone, and goodbye.